For the first time ever, the relics of Saint Therese of Lisieux, one of the world's best-loved saints, are in the UK and will be travelling across England and Wales over the next 4 weeks. Born in 1873, Therese spent all her adulthood in a Carmelite convent in northern France and died at the age of 24. But despite her short and uneventful life, Therese's fame soon spread around the globe following the publication of her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, shortly after her death. As a measure of its appeal, the autobiography has been translated into some 50 languages, millions of copies have been sold, and it's never been out of print. Shortly after the centenary of her death in 1997, Saint Therese's relics began touring the world and have visited over 40 countries to date. In Britain, the historic tour of her relics officially got underway on Wednesday in the southwestern city of Portsmouth, and organisers are expecting large crowds to turn out at many of the 22 different venues the relics will visit, that include many Catholic cathedrals and parishes, a prison, a hospice, and an Anglican cathedral. The national organiser of the tour of Therese's relics in England and Wales is Monsignor Keith Baltrop, director of a Catholic agency to support evangelisation, and he spoke to me about his hopes and expectations just ahead of the visit.
I think the main significance is that it gives people a very concrete opportunity to focus on the communion of saints, and in particular this remarkable saint who was not only so much blessed by God, but has clearly been given a mission to the church. I mean, we've been speaking a lot about evangelization in the last few years in the church, and St. Therese, of course, is patron of the mission. I think her visit will act as a stimulus to people to engage in a deeper in mission at a deeper level.
How and why did the request for this visit of her relics come about?
St. Therese's, I would say, always been much loved in England and Wales. I mean, some of the great writers on St. Therese have been English. One thinks of people like Monsignor Vernon Johnson. There are thousands, possibly millions of people in England who love St. Therese. And hearing about the way her relics have travelled around many other countries of the world, I think it was natural that people began to wonder, well, why hasn't she been here?
In fact, you mentioned how they've travelled around the world. In fact, I gather they've already been to 40 other countries. Why does this 19th century nun, who lived almost all of her life in a small remote town in northern France, have this huge global appeal?
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, there is, if you read her writing somewhere, she does have this remarkable statement that I want to be a missionary till the end of time. I want to be a missionary on all five continents. I mean, it sounds, I suppose, like the typical sort of youthful daydreaming or idealism, but the extraordinary thing is, through her visit of her relics, she has, in a way, had her dream come true. It's an extraordinary story, I suppose, of the power of God, of how God works through people who are very little and humble. I suppose precisely at a time in the 20th century, you know, when the two great power blocks of communism and Nazism were seen to be battling it out for the soul of the world, it's as if God was saying, well, you know, I work in a different way. I work through small people, humble people, and yet very, very powerfully, much more powerfully and much more long-lasting.
And it was her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, that was published almost by accident, I gather, after her death, that made her famous. Why does this book have such an impact? I gather it's been translated into 50 languages and millions of copies have been sold, and it's never been out of print. I mean, these are fairly amazing statistics, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, like many saints or great mystics for that matter, Saint Therese was reluctant naturally to speak about herself. She would never have publicized herself. It was only at the command of her superiors, one of whom of course was her natural sister, who, you know, had some inkling of what was going on in her life, that she wrote her autobiography. Still, even when she died, most of the sisters in the convent, you know, thought that she was fairly unremarkable. It's hard to say. I mean, one has to admit that, you know, you have to get past a little bit of the sugary language, a bit like the image that sort of touched-up image of her that was purveyed by some of the nuns after her death. But once you get beyond that, you see someone. It's something about the extreme simplicity and the obvious sincerity and authenticity of what she experienced and the sheer depth of it. like so many of the saints, like the Curia of Ars, who we're thinking about in this year of the priesthood, it seems very simple and almost obvious on the surface. I was going to use the word banal, but that might be the wrong word to use. But if you allow yourself to be touched by it, you see there's extraordinary depths in it, that something of the simplicity of her message, the little way of spiritual childhood, you know, speaks to people in a very complicated age. It's not superficial. It's something of the way that God really touches you if you allow yourself to be empty and humble and not self-sufficient, but open to his grace.
Now, you talked earlier there about this sometimes sugary image that's being portrayed of her, but she had actually quite a lot of suffering, didn't she? And she had her moments of huge doubts about her faith, a bit like Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Do you think all these elements help people to relate to her?
Very much so, yes. I think you've hit on an absolutely central part of her life. She experienced great doubts, really, about the existence of heaven, even of God himself at times, physical suffering, not just physical suffering, but she'd had her fair share of mental suffering, which of course is such a feature of people in the 20th and 21st century. I mean, her childhood could in some ways be described as rather neurotic. She was healed of a kind of self-preoccupation, she says, by a vision of Our Lady. And, you know, even as an adult, she was not free of impatience, tendencies to be negative about the other sisters. I mean, life in the convent, although it was very routine and very hard, was also, you know, extremely difficult. One might say rather petty compared to the difficulties other people have. But then, of course, she suffered enormously physically from what appears to have been tuberculosis, not properly diagnosed. And part of her teaching is, you know, you don't have to try to be a hero. Your very weaknesses, if you allow them, even your sins, if you allow them, can become a means of humility and therefore a means of drawing down God's mercy. You know, that God is really attracted to people who are humble and empty of any pride. That's what he's really looking for in people.
So how much excitement and interest is there among Catholics in England and Wales, and indeed among the wider community in Britain, ahead of this visit?
There does seem to be a growing sense of momentum and excitement. People say, well, you know, there is enormous enthusiasm for this. There's a real sense of this is something that is, in a sense, overdue, that it's high time that it happened. We've left it very much to each venue to plan how they're going to use the time they have. And many of them, for example, are holding all-night vigils with young people, holding special services of healing for the sick, events for families. Coaches are being organized from all the different parishes. Schools are involved. And I think possibly, you know, coming as it does this sort of time of the year, the beginning of the academic year, it's a good time. There's a sense of something new in the air, and it's a good time for a visit like this to take place.
There has been some criticism, though, even within the Catholic community. Some see this tour of the relics and even all the other touring that's been done of them across the world as rather bizarre or ghoulish. What's your answer to these critics?
I can understand those comments, those ideas, because it's not every day that you get the bones of a 19th century saint travelling around the world. And some people, of course, would say, you know, the whole business of relics should be, I was going to say decently buried, but that might be the best way to put it, but you know what I mean, that it's something that pertains to the Middle Ages. I think on the contrary, in a strange sort of way, the sort of what sometimes we call the postmodern mentality is much more open to these things. If you think, you know, that John Lennon's piano travelled round England. If you think of all the hype over things belonging to Princess Diana or Elvis, you know, one's almost tempted to say that perhaps people outside the church might almost be a bit more open to these things than some Catholics. You know, it is sometimes said, isn't it, that just as the church puts something aside, the rest of the world discovers it. You know, just as we stop talking about angels, everyone else is suddenly talking about angels. Perhaps here is an opportunity for the church to learn from contemporary culture that relics and objects associated with, for us holy people, actually have a great importance.
And what sort of crowds are you expecting in some of the larger venues that the relics will visit? I mean, is it likely that quite a lot of these crowds, in fact, will come, as we talked about just now, out of this rather ghoulish curiosity rather than out of a real faith?
I think a lot of... I wouldn't want to judge that anybody is coming out of ghoulish curiosity. I mean, I hope that everyone who comes, whether Catholic or not, will come in a spirit of openness to at least to receive something from God, even if it's just a, you know, the next step on their path to God. It's very difficult for us to say. When the relics went to Ireland, which is our nearest neighbour, huge crowds were drawn. Whether we'll have quite so many, it's difficult to say. I know that some of the venues, particularly in the north of England, which perhaps are more traditionally Catholic, are preparing for huge crowds, or at least they're preparing for the eventuality of huge crowds, but in a sense we can only wait and see.
So, to sum up, do you anticipate or hope that this tour will help bring about conversions to Catholicism, or else help bring people back to the church who might have strayed from the fold?
Well, all we know is that from previous visits there are many testimonies of people whose lives have been deeply touched by the visit to the relics. Some people discover their vocation, some people, yes, have a conversion experience, whether it's to Catholicism or back to the faith, whatever it might be. Other people just seem to have an answer to their problems. I suppose a bit like going to Lourdes. So we treat it very much as a sort of pilgrimage in reverse. You know, many people go on pilgrimage these days in the expectation of, you know, that effort will help to bring about some sort of enlightenment or change in their lives. This is not us going to a holy place, this is a holy person coming to us. And I think that we can expect, yes, many miracles.
I was speaking to Monsignor Keith Baltrop, national organiser of the Tour of St. Therese's Relics in the UK.